You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, June 23rd, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Megan Erickson, editor of The Jacobin, author of the forthcoming Class War on the Assault on Education. Also on the program today, Nikki Haley finally calls for the pulling down of the South Carolina flag. Or I should say the Confederate flag. Walmart will also stop selling hate accessories. The TPA, or I should say at least the cloture vote, and ultimately the Fast Track Authority, passes just moments ago in the Senate. Meanwhile, Ready for Warren becomes Ready to Fight for Bernie Sanders, and Donald Trump is now number two in New Hampshire. And, of course, Jackie Mason. Free speech is only for minorities now, sadly. Ladies and gentlemen. All right, folks. Sorry, we're a little bit hectic at the beginning of the show today. Still got to figure out how to do our soundboard. Brand new technology, apparently. The vote just happened in the Senate. Pretty depressing. Ultimately, it was about 61 to 49. Technically, it was 60 to 37 in terms of moving forward with the vote on the TPA, but that was indicative of what the vote on the Fast Track Authority will be. This will be signed by President Obama, despite a last-minute defection from Ted Cruz. There were multiple Dems, 13 of them, in fact, who essentially sold out their constituents. Ron Wyden, Dianne Feinstein, others as well, Heidi Heitkamp. We'll have the full list of Democrats shortly. Patty Murray, not unexpected. But this was, you know, a lot of people write that the presidents rarely or, in fact, never lose when it comes to trade bills. It is unclear if there's anything else that could basically derail this. The only other chance, I guess, at this point, well, that was basically it. It's quite possible that Boehner and McConnell will pull the old switcheroo, and in the House, you will not be able to get the trade adjustment assistance. It will remain to be seen. supposedly the deal is that will happen as a mitigating factor. It's not much in terms of the grand policy involved here. It will mean something to some small amount of workers. But largely speaking, these trade pacts are very problematic. But President Obama won. So hope is restored. Speaking of which, we'll also talk later in the program about Mark Maron's interview with President Obama. A lot of people on Twitter saying that it's not quite of the same import as Andy Kindler's interview on this program on Friday. I know that I agree with that, but nevertheless, we will talk about that as well. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Megan Erickson on the techno assault on education. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Megan Erickson, editor at The Jacobin, author of the forthcoming Class War to be released in the fall. Welcome to the program, Megan.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, let's your latest piece in Jacobin. The Edutopia takes on, the latest school reformers, but specifically in terms of the idea of the day, that technology will be the sort of the savior for us. Let's start with first IDEO. And I love the names of these companies that are that are developing this stuff. The design thinking for educators. What is that?
Right. So very very techie sorts of names. Innova is the one that I talk about in the essay. Often coming up with ideas that. With teachers that have been really there for years, like, for example, Paulo Freire, who I also write about in the essay, was an educator in Brazil who created an entire pedagogy called, his main book is Pedagogy of the Oppressed. And, it was a student-centered method. A lot of what we see from reformers today claims to be student-centered, but it's actually rooted in ideas that come from really the turn of the 20th century, like B.F. Skinner, for example, was creating a teaching machine. And the idea is that every student will move at his or her own pace. And, you know, they'll only be able to move on to the next question once they've given a right answer. So it sounds very student-centered. And to be sure, the Falcon website that you can access today, Falcon is funded by the Gates Foundation and is part of Bill Gates, who's one of the biggest education reformers in the business right now. It's really the same thing. Not much has changed since those early sort of glorified digitized textbooks. So design thinking, and along with all of the technological adoptions that have gone on in schools currently, are really they're sets of ideas that are really baseless. There's not much substance to them.
You talk about Ferrer developing a critique of this banking model of education, later you refer to the design thinking for educators as having an abundance mentality. Talk about that, because that it's interesting, because it seems like outside of education, and perhaps maybe this was the case too when had people like Skinner promoting sort of a similar approach. But everything is now data driven, and everything is sort of having a positive mentality to bring about positive change, which is all well and good. I try and be positive at times. When these ideas first originated, in terms of these ideas of being able to sort of, or at least were envisioned, where each student could be, addressed individually by technology, was there a similar sort of a thing going on in society, or is it? Are we seeing this confluence now, I guess?
Yeah, so exactly. So Skinner was working at the turn of the century through the 50s and died in the 80s. And I would say that's a similar, what we were seeing was the adoption of Peter Drucker type management. Ideology, but it does have kind of a theological tenor to it. When we saw more mechanization going on in the workforce, higher need for accountability, more standardization. So it makes perfect sense that these people who were psychiatrists, psychologists, not really known for their concerns about human beings as human beings and focused on efficiency, it makes sense that they would want to put that in classrooms as well.
And so let's talk a little bit about Innova. This is a school, or I should say, I guess, a company that made schools down in Peru, is it right?
Yes.
All right. Tell us about this experience, because I think, for some reason, when the example in Peru, I think, shows sort of how the rubber meets the road when we talk about these sort of, I guess I would describe Innova as almost sort of like some elements of the charter movement in this country.
Yeah. So Innova was started by a Peruvian billionaire. He lived in New York for many years. I remember I was researching him, and I read one of the pieces I read on him. He had objected to renting an apartment without a terrace, furiously. So not a guy who was ever really focused on education as much as, banking and building a business empire in Peru. In fact, Innova is part of a portfolio that he has of grocery stores and movie theaters that are all focused at the emerging middle class in Peru. And he is very clear about that. What I found was...
Can I stop you right there? There's so much about, we hear about hedge funds investing in charter schools. We see this guy investing in this sort of a series of private schools. What is it about these schools that are so profitable? I mean, what makes them as I guess, alluring as a supermarket chain?
Well, that's a good question. I think that at this point, neither Inova, the network, it's becoming, I think in February, it became the largest network of private schools in Peru. I'm not even sure that schools themselves are being looked at as the most profitable place to put your money, but I think that we're in the beginning stages of people really looking at them as spaces that should be privatized. So, like, for example, a lot of people who have, people like Sal Khan, founder of Khan Academy, who, like I said, it's funded by the Gates Foundation. A website, by the way, that I was not very impressed with. I logged on and got my credentials and everything, and it is really like a glorified textbook. But anyway, so he visited Inova and said he was absolutely blown away. It's beautiful. It's open. It's modern. He was inspired to see an affordable school deliver an education that would rival schools in the richest countries. But the question is who is that affordable for? So tuition at Inova is $130 a month, which sounds, you know, that's considerably below what Americans pay, which for a private school can be $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 a year. But it's really, in terms of the median income in Peru, it's a good chunk of that. People would be paying $430 a month to have their kids attend. So really, American reformers are looking at these schools as models for American school systems, but they're not inclusive at all. They're not public. They're not open. They're great. You can look at the website and get excited about it. There's great modern spaces. You'll see children in school on laptops doing actually pretty interesting projects, but they're you know, siloed into working with kids of the same exact class background.
I just want to reiterate the numbers. You wrote it's $130 a month to attend this school, but the average monthly income of a family living in Peru's median household is $430. So we're talking about over a quarter of the family's income going to these schools.
Yeah.
So I guess theoretically in this country, it would be the equivalent of like $14,000 annually, or I guess, yeah, $14,000 annually to go to this private school, which is not, that's not affordable in America. It's not affordable, I think, even obviously in Peru, if you're talking about the average family.
Right. And IDEO, who helped, IDEO is a design thinking firm. They sort of coined the idea and the movement behind design thinking. And they were in charge. They oversaw the rollout of Inova schools. And they look at the test scores that come from the schools and, you know, use them to sort of trumpet the fact that they've delivered on what their mantra and ideal for the project was, which is affordability, scalability, and excellence. But the fact that the test scores are higher than those of public schools in Peru, it means really little when you think about the fact that one of the most consistent patterns in educational research of the past half century is that socioeconomic status of a child's parents is one of the strongest predictors of his or her academic success. And that's a pretty startling finding. Schools in general account for only 30% of roughly, that's what folks have found, a general figure of test scores. So that's not exactly a strong finding on the part of IDEO.
Just to be clear on that, and I think the numbers for teachers is somewhere around like 7%, right? So in
right,
other words,
because when yeah, because when you're talking about schools, you're talking about a whole environment with administrators, even the building and what's going on inside the building. The classroom teaching is a much smaller percent of that 30%.
So these are not the biggest factors are basically, again, is another classic case of the biggest factors are basically what's the input. I mean, who these students are and where they come from on day one is going to determine the vast majority of the odds of them succeeding well by any measure, I guess, as they come out of school at the end of whatever it is, 5, 6, 8 years.
Right, which is the fundamental problem with arguing for technology and design thinking and problem solving as a substitute for school funding or redistribution of wealth.
But isn't the argument, and I want to move forward and take on that argument, but the argument from technologists is that, well, it may be the case now that only 30% of a student's, I guess, success is a function of the school, and the other 70% may be other issues, their family's wealth, where they live, what they're exposed to, et cetera, et cetera. But if
right.
we have technology in the classroom, that number could go up to 50% or 60% instead of 30%.
Right, and that's not really what we've found. That's not supported by educational research. Again, the processes in the class, well, first of all, in terms of Innova, since it's a private network, that's not even their own sort of stated goals. It's just goals that are kind of being put on them by the American education reformers. But in terms of education reform, we're not going to increase the reason why there's so much difficulty in having technology adopted in the classroom in deep ways is that we have a test accountability regime that makes it really hard for teachers to do that. They can't use technology in interesting and meaningful ways that will actually help students when they're constantly teaching to the test. So it's really not surprising that the kinds of programs that are being created by Pearson, for example, we're not really seeing results. Like, for example, the LA Unified School District a couple of years ago started an initiative to offer one-to-one computing for kids, every child in the school district, which is the second largest in the entire country, was supposed to get an iPad loaded with Pearson software. The school district spent $1.3 billion, I think, on the project, but they neglected to do any teacher training. So there is zero professional development around it. English teachers who were in charge of giving the devices to students were given a 40-minute overview of how it worked. So it's not really surprising that it didn't make it to full adoption. And at this point,
aren't they looking for their money back?
Yeah,
I think
April, I think, of 2015, they opened a lawsuit and are trying to sue for the money back.
Well, when you're talking about $1.3 billion worth of iPads and, I guess, an app, it becomes pretty clear what the motive is and where the money is in this business. And you're only talking about one school district. Granted, it is one of the largest in the country. But talk about the idea of that is also sort of inherent in an instrument like an app, an iPad that has this Pearson data, and this notion of individually prescribed instruction that is sort of embedded in the thinking of this technology.
Yeah, so one thing that I was really struck by when I was doing research for this article, which I went on to elaborate and became part of a book chapter for my book that's coming out, I came across a film that was made by B.F. Skinner to promote the teaching machine that he had been working on. And it's utopian in the worst sense. It's really terrifying. So we see kids at desks sitting at machines. You know, the room is totally silent. There's no interaction going on from student to student. So there's really a problem from, you know, from my perspective and the perspective of a lot of teachers and a lot of research as well, that we're not teaching kids collaborative skills. We're teaching them that, you know, they get the answer right and then they move on to the next question. So sure, in one sense, in a very, very superficial sense, that is student-centered learning, but it's really only student-centered learning. And then it stops at the individual student, and it means that, you know, students aren't collaborating with groups. We all know that knowledge is contentious, right? Like, particularly after this century. I mean, this whole vision for what education should do is about, it sort of takes for granted that knowledge is something that we can just input into a single computer and it comes out and the student memorizes it and then they move on to the next question. So yes, you may be doing a better job ensuring that every student picks up these, you know, very specific ideas about, you know, what is a fraction, for example. But you're not necessarily involving them in their education in a deeper way. You're not teaching them to talk to each other, to create meaning, to talk to a teacher. So there's really, really not a lot of guidance in terms of social emotional skills.
And the problem is that you can teach a kid I guess 3/4 is the same as 6/8, but they don't necessarily know how to apply this stuff, right? I mean, they haven't learned how to learn as opposed to just sort of absorbing information.
Yeah, and more importantly, they haven't learned how to learn critically, how to think critically. They're being taught something pretty insidious underneath all of this, which is that knowledge is coming from a higher source. Maybe that's not the teacher, but that doesn't mean it's student-centered just because it's coming from, you know, your iPad.
And so the insidiousness of that is that there are certain gatekeepers, and it creates a hierarchical type of perspective. Is that it?
Yeah, it creates a hierarchical understanding of what it means to learn, what it means to be a learner, what it means to be a citizen, ultimately, because schools are not operating in a vacuum. They're a child's first introduction to public life, right? So it really shapes how you see your role in society.
And so you wrote at one point, conflating the future with unambiguous universal progress puts us all on equal footing. What does that mean when you're talking about like this techno utopian speak?
Yeah. So the idea that we're all sort of working together to solve this problem it really obscures the fact that we know a lot of the problems that exist in our educational system. We know why students are scoring so low on tests in particular specific areas. And conflating all students as one body it elides the class of students and where students are coming from. And the fact that one student is starting off with, you know, totally different resources than another student.
Why do you think, I mean, when you contemplate like the Gateses, for instance, I mean, do you think they don't know that? I mean, this is the thing that I think is sort of, you know, just sort of I wrestle with all the time. I mean, surely they must know what the data says, right? Or is it just that it is just so hard to accept that there is some predetermination that is a function of a larger societal problem that they just don't want to accept it?
I think it's probably a combination of both. I think I've seen that Gates has had a lot of leeway as a billionaire, as a donor and philanthropist, particularly in New York City public schools, where we tried the whole small school thing, which it was about taking bigger schools and making them smaller, and that was supposed to transform the problems of education overnight without adding any additional resources to the schools, which of course is not how it worked out. And then I believe it was in 2011, he gave a speech saying, yeah, I was really wrong about that. Well, our schools aren't laboratories for billionaires to be experimenting in. So I do think there's a level on which he and the Gates Foundation are earnest about trying to work things out, but they're not accountable to anyone, and so they're not using research that already exists. In fact, they're often openly hostile. I mean, he's repeatedly called for austerity in public education. So on one level, that may be true, but on another, I do think this is a managerial. The fact that we're applying managerial and industrial logic to classrooms is not an accident. They're seeing students as future workers, and that's something that comes up again and again in Arne Duncan, the U.S. Secretary of Education, in his speeches, in Gates speeches, you know, over and over. They say, can we find ways to scale the amazing teachers we have? Well, what does that mean? Scale means, you know, cut out other teachers. And the issue is that amazing teachers are not born that way. They're not heroes that are coming in to save the education system. Amazing teachers are created and they're trained.
And at one point, you quote Arne Duncan asking, Arne Duncan being the Secretary of Education who came out of the Chicago school system, asking a room full of Silicon Valley entrepreneurs and investors, can we find ways to scale the amazing teachers we do
right,
have? Explain
yeah.
to us what he means by scale in that instance.
Okay, so to scale in business lingo means to retain quality with an increased workload. So modifying teachers to scale is really just about efficiency. It's about possibly replacing them with robots or computers who do better, possibly
I mean,
not.
That different. Just the idea that you would talk about scaling individual teachers is just
yeah.
a bizarre thing. Like it's almost as if like you're saying, can we take some of their DNA and clone them in some way, or can we put them in a room and broadcast them out to schools across the country? Right. I mean, that's what they're talking about. It seems to me, can we have like a virtual classroom where we have our great teachers actually teaching instead of 20 kids or 30 kids, they could be teaching 300 kids at a time.
Right, yeah. And another thing that is a consistent finding of education research is that small class sizes are hugely important. And actually, they're hugely important to parents as well. So, you know, teachers, educational researchers, it's something that becomes intuitive to you the longer that you've taught or the longer that you've observed classes. But it's also something that the parents of American school children are strongly behind.
So where are we on this? I mean, you know, it seems to me that over the course of the past year or two, the so-called reformers have begun to lose some of their momentum. I mean, I think, you know, part of that is just sort of oddly there's this conservative pushback against Common Core, not necessarily for the same reasons that that others have pushed back against it, but that there's this sort of...
conservatives have been pushing back against national curriculum for 100 years. So, yeah, I don't think that's reason for optimism.
Well, I mean, but has it also added to the slowing of the role of reformers? I mean, in other words, you know, when you have... parents opting out of tests, right? It hurts the so-called reform movement, but I don't know what the breakdown is. But a certain percentage of those parents who are opting out are doing so because they think, you know, Common Core is a way for Obama to inculcate their kids as communists. At the end of the day, you don't know exactly what the breakdown is, and so it certainly strengthens, it seems to me, teachers and parents. Give me your sense of what the state of play is in this reform movement.
Yeah, I'm optimistic in the long run. I agree with you. I think that's a really important question that we're only just now starting to see. I'm excited to see more and more backlash, more and more op-eds in newspapers, more students fighting back, and teachers supporting them. You know, as teachers' unions become more and more about social justice instead of just bread and butter issues, that can only help the movement. I mean, I really think what we need is a national movement, and movements take a lot of time. And this is going to be a long game. But I agree with you. I think we're starting to see a turn just because parents are so frustrated. I see kids every day who are really being burdened by how much homework they have, how much, test prep they have in class every day. It's not fun for them. And another thing that I really think is important, I didn't get into this as much in the particular article, Edutopia, but it's in my book, is that we need to not just be thinking about kids as human capital, as a national resource. I think it's horrible when we talk about children as our most precious resource. Children are alive. They're people today. They're living today. And I think another thing that teachers and parents really care about is how their quality of life in the day to day, because that's important too. We're not just putting it's not right to just put the burden of our economic power on the shoulders of children as future workers.
Great place to end it, and we will looking forward to the publication of your book Class War in the fall. Megan Erickson, editor of Jacobin, and the piece is Edutopia. We will link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
All right, folks. Going to head into the fun half of the program, where we will talk about the fun involved in those 13 Democrats who voted with the Republicans in favor of cloture on the Trade Promotion Authority in the Senate. That's going to basically seal the deal going forward. The only sort of question extant is whether or not there will be a trade adjustment assistance that will go through. But that is going to do very little for some of the worst problems of the TPA. We will talk about that. And then we will have some fun with Donald Trump being number two now in New Hampshire in the Republican presidential race. Also, we will talk about the latest of and the value of the symbolism of a insurrectionist racist flag no longer at least flying over one state capitol or next to one state capital. Maybe a second. Mississippi is also now talking about it. It's obviously not ending racism, not ending gun violence, not ending hate, but symbols have a meaning. They actually do have meanings. This is a step in the right direction, presuming that it actually does end up being pulled down in South Carolina. Certainly in Walmart, it's going to have an impact. You can no longer buy or will no longer be able to buy any Confederate flag motifs. You will be able to buy a ton of guns.
eBay just banned the selling of Confederate flag things, too.
eBay has too, and I imagine Amazon's going to follow suit shortly after, if they haven't already. And it makes a difference. It really does make a difference. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Folks, remember, your show, your support is the primary support of this program. 98.65, I think we were at, percent of our revenue comes from you, our members. So it is your support that makes this show possible. Become a member today at majority.fm. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Shipping is free now, and you get 10% off using the coupon code MAJORITY. Check it out. People love Just Coffee. .coop. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majoritycreditreportkickback.com and pick up the app at majorityapp.com. It is totally free, and it's a fun way to IM the show or a very easy way to search the archives and listen to the program. Going to take a quick break, 646-257-3920 if you want to be a part of the program. 646-257-3920 if you want to be a part of the program. We'll be right back after this.